installation in the world. Once you've solved the very simple problem of feeding a 3,000 ohm impedance instead of a 50 ohm impedance, one simple LC network right at that dipole at the bottom will do that for you. And the so-called Berkeley equation, you go to impedance matching Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y. Google those words. You'll see this beautiful program where once you know the impedance of the antenna, and the Brown and Woodward curves will tell you that, the Brown and Woodward curves you can find in every issue, the fourth chapter of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. You can also find it on the Mike and Mike website, K1MJM and K2NJI. Those two websites will show you the Brown and Woodward curves. And the length of the antenna, the length of the antenna, the Brown and Woodward curve will tell you exactly what resistive component and reactive components you're going to get. The Berkeley equation, the Berkeley program, the website, you go there and it says, what's the resistive component and the reactive component of the impedance of your load? What's the resistive component and the reactive component of your signal generator, which is probably 50 ohms? What's the frequency you're using it at? You plug in those numbers and you press go, and then Berkeley will give you 16 solutions. You choose the ones that you like, of a simple L network of an inductor, capacitor, a capacitor inductor, a pi network, a T network, a pi T L. Choose whatever one you like. All the performance is right there. All the equations are worked out. And now all you know is that you need X number of microhenry of coil. Berkeley will tell you that, so to speak. They'll tell you what reactance it needs. Or I think they tell you actually how many microhenry. You go to the chapter number one or two of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, and it tells you if you wind this number of turns of wire on that diameter, you'll get that many microhenries. So it's all deterministic, as you can tell. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the deck band.
There's a lot of information available out there. It is just wonderful. You don't have to crack as many books. All there, it's a little bit of a piece of bill that you can buy. So take advantage there. Okay, and I'll see what email comes down from Roy and see the question. Instead of dropping on one, the next one is late, so I want to get one more in.
You said complete the answer. There is no complete answer to anything, John. You and I have found that out a long time ago. If you think the problem is simple, you don't understand the problem. If you think you know everything about RF, going to be humbled. So, do we know everything? Not a chance. But we know a little bit more. Go ahead, John.
As long as we know how to test what we're looking, we should be able to find the answer, know the answer, what's out there if we want to look. That's for sure.
And you said we find the answer. That implies that there's only one answer. When you are synthesizing a structure, you're synthesizing a circuit, you're synthesizing an amplifier, you're synthesizing an oscillator, you're synthesizing an impedance matching network to an antenna, you're synthesizing an antenna. Every one of these synthesizers, it has an infinite number of solutions. And you, as a good ham radio operator, or a good designer, a good engineer, you're going to choose the one that's good enough, that's economically viable, that's got a good cost-to-benefit ratio today with what you know today. There's a large number of solutions to every one of these. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Well, you're absolutely right, Dick. I found that in most of my efforts to discover an answer, the answer works, but along with that, more questions develop. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Let me let it drop on what the next one is. Okay. I have a young gentleman who's working, and he's got a question on directional couplers. Working at about 900 megahertz as a directional coupler, he's purchased an EV, and wants to use it direction. What does he have to look for, and how do you think that's going to work out for him? Back to you, please.
It's going to work like a charm. I have often done exactly that. A directional coupler is a purely passive bidirectional device. Usually is laid out in a NADA manner with a blue package with a red label on it. And if you take it apart, you'll see it's a strip line circuit which has got a 50 ohm, approximately 50 ohm straight through piece of cable inside with the left-hand input connector and the out main output right-hand connector. The connector with a 50-ohm piece of strip line. Parallel to that strip line is the coupled line. So a little bit off to one side, parallel to the first line, but approximately a quarter wavelength at the center frequency, quarter wavelength long. At one side, it's got a 50-ohm resistor, and the other side, it's got the third connector. So it's 10 dB directional coupling when he's using it in the forward mode. Let me drop it. Let's assume he takes the signal generator and sets it for 0 dBm of output, which really means 1 milliwatt. So he's got 1 milliwatt flowing through the straight-through line. And at the far end, it's going to a 50-ohm bending load that he has added to the output connector of this directional coupler. Now the third connector is going to take a sample, a 10 dB coupler, it's going to take a sample 10 dB down, 1/10 of power. So he's putting 1 milliwatt through the thing on the straight-through line. Roughly 9/10 of a watt is going to come out of the straight-through line. The directional line will create a signal minus 10 dBm, 1/10 of a milliwatt. And if he reverses the directional coupler, so now he's feeding it backwards, so to speak, nothing will come out of that third connector. That's its directivity. And if it's reasonably well made, every self-respecting directional coupler has got 15 to 20 dB of directivity. A really good one has got 30 dB of directivity. An instrumentation-grade directional coupler has 50 dB of directivity. In other words, the signal in the desired direction will be 10 dB down. The signal in the undesired direction will be 60 dB down. 50 dB difference. That's the directivity. Let me drop. But this thing is thoroughly bidirectional. The way I just described it is the conventional way of using it. Because the straight-through line has 9/10 of the power always flowing through, you could use this as an injecting device. You could install this on the cable going to the antenna. The antenna cable, the main signal is flowing through the straight-through line, and 90% of the signal always goes there. And now you want to inject a very weak signal back into the receiver to act as a calibrator. Nothing's stopping you from injecting your weak signal into that directional coupler port, and now you're using the directional coupler port, the third port, in reverse. You use it backwards. It obeys reciprocity. With a forward-flowing signal on the directional line, on the straight-through line, the coupled line is giving you a signal at sample 10 dB down. You put a minus 10 dBm signal in there, you're now using it backwards, so to speak, at some other frequency. It still has 10 dB of coupling coefficient. It's now going to give you a minus 20 dB signal in the direction back towards the signal generator, which maybe is a receiver, and it's going to obey the exact same directivity. It will be injecting a little bit of signal in the wrong direction, but if it's got 20 dB of directivity, the wrong direction signal will be 20 dB weaker. So directional couplers are beautiful, calibrated signal injectors. Let me drop. And once you realize the power of this, if your directional coupler had, let me pick a number, 40 or 50 dB of directivity, it's got a very light, I said directivity, 40 or 50 dB of coupling coefficient, it's got very light coupling. That really means there's a large gap between the coupled line and the straight through line. That has an extremely valuable piece of test equipment that you use with a broadcast transmitter. You've got a broadcast transmitter that's running 10,000 watts. Wouldn't use a 10 dB coupler, which means 1,000 watts is coming out of that directional port. You ain't going to put that into your spectrum analyzer. You use a 50 or 60 dB coupler with a coupling coefficient of 50 or 60 dB, negative dB. Now you're taking a very small sample. Use a big enough number of decibels of negative coupling coefficient. You can now take this 10 kilowatt transmitter and sample 1 milliwatt of it by choosing the right kind of a directional coupler. And now the straight-through insertion loss, under the laws of conservation of energy, this essentially goes to zero. And how easy is it for you to put a slight little probe inside of your piece of waveguide, which is sampling some of that signal 50 dB down, and putting a resistor on the end of that probe and setting it up just right with the right length to spacing ratio to the wall, you can make a directional coupler. It's not rocket science. And that allows you to take a sample of what's going on the 10 kilowatt transmitter. Your instrumentation is going to be connected to that that little I'm going to call it whisker. I'm going to call it a gimmicking device, but it really is a directional coupler with a very small coupling coefficient, a very large number of dBs, so to speak. And now I can sample 1 milliwatt of it, plug it into my spectrum analyzer, and look at the quality of the signal coming out of this 10-kilowatt broadcast transmitter that's transmitting a beautiful picture right now. And your spectrum analyzer is going to tell you what the spectrum looks like. So, directional coupling.
Repeater, timeout.
So as you can see, directional couplers are very handy for sampling what your transmitter is doing, very handy for injecting signals into your receiver, or maybe back to the transmitter. You might want to, and this is one of the things that Eric and I were discussing last night, you might want to find out what is the real output impedance of your transmitter, not 50 ohms, almost never. To adjust the transmitter so that it gives the best performance when it's looking at a 50-ohm load. You have power matched it. You have intermodulation distortion matched it. Never match it for impedance with rare exceptions. Of course, that sounds crazy. The real impedance of a tetro tube, for instance, is so close to a constant current generator, it's almost an open circuit. You take the output port of that transmitter and you look back into it. You're looking at almost an open circuit. Even though it's cranking out 10 kilowatts, it's almost an open circuit. So that any signal that's reflected from your antenna, because of standing wave ratio, it comes all the way back to the transmission line and it hits the transmitter. It gets re-reflected forward because it has nowhere else to go. In the case of digital television or high-quality analog television, that signal is now bouncing back and forth between your antenna and that transmitter. It's called the triple transit problem. In the case of analog picture, it's going to give you a ghost in the picture. In the case of digital transmission, it's going to give you inter-symbol distortion. And maybe the poor digital converter of the guy that's trying to receive his television signal is not going to get anything. I mean, God forbid. So if you're doing a real good design on your television broadcast transmitter and antenna, start off making sure the standing wave ratio of the antenna is as low as you can get it. And then the next step you worry about is, what is the real output impedance of the transmitter? Of the signal that's reflected back from the antenna, will the transmitter absorb it? What percentage of it will the transmitter absorb? What percentage of it's going to be re-reflected forward as a triple transit signal that's going to be creating distortion of that beautiful digital signal or ghost in an analog signal? And so, by way of a directional coupler, could inject a signal back into the transmitter and find out what happens. You inject it with one directional coupler. With another directional coupler, you find out what the result was, how much of it got re-reflected from the transmitter forward again. And by that experiment, carefully done, not easy, you can literally measure what is the real output impedance of that transmitter under high-power working conditions by way of directional couplers. And there's nothing stopping you from stacking two or three of them along the transmission line to do sampling at the different frequencies, sampling at different coupling coefficients, injection in different directions, properly used, it's an extremely useful tool. Let me drop it. When Donner manufactures those directional couplers, they are typically $1,000, $1,500, fairly expensive. And you see them at flea markets for $5 and $10. And the average ham radio operator looks at those, turns up his nose, and keeps on walking. Doesn't know what he's looking at. On top of that, he looks at the label on it, and he finds out that it's rated for 500 to 1,000 megacycles. And he's a 2-meter operator or a 432 operator. Again, he turns up his nose and walks away from it. He doesn't realize that a directional coupler keeps almost all of its directivity. It works beautifully at lower and lower frequencies than the label tells you. And the power falls off in a very controlled manner. That directional coupler that's rated for 10 dB of coupling coefficient from 500 to 1,000 megs, and you're going to use it at 144 megs, instead of it being a 10 dB coupler, you go through the mathematics, maybe it's a 17 dB coupler with the same directivity. So that directional coupler has a smaller and smaller coupling coefficient when you go to lower in frequencies, but it works all the way down to DC. to take that 500 to 1,000 megacycle rated directional coupler and use it at 3.5 megacycles if you're smart enough. And it'll work like a charm. I've done it many times. KC2WGB, K2RAW, these are very worthwhile things to study, John. Go ahead.
Yes, they are, and I've done a few experiments with them. Very interesting, and you can learn a lot. Also, his question, he wants to know if he's correct in assuming that if he has through the neighbor to the exit port, 0 dB signal, on the sample port, if he injects 10 dB signal, 10 dB, will that come out at the same amplitude?
Yes. It is a thoroughly reciprocal device. And because it is directional, it looks at first like it's violating reciprocity. You got to be careful how you use this now. If in the forward mode signal, it is a minus 10 dB coupling coefficient coupler, it has 10 dB of loss, so to speak, between the main input port and the third coupled port, and the 10 dB works in both directions, so that 0 dBm on the straight through line is going to give you a minus 10 on the coupled line. Put in plus 10 on the coupled line, it will inject back into the main line 0. It's got exactly 10 dB of loss, whether you're using it between port 1 and 3 or between port 3 and 1. It's got the same 10 dB in that particular direction, if you know what I mean. 10 dB of loss, so therefore you boost up the signal by 10 dB and re-inject it, and you'll come back with the exact same amplitude that you started off with in the signal generator on the main input port. He's got it right. Over to you, John, K2RAW.
Very good. But now, you were, when you was about set up with those couplers for Eric's testing, those tests would be S22 and S21, is that correct?
When it comes to trying to evaluate the quality of the digital signal he's transmitting, first of all, he's trying to create ridiculous linearity and pre-distortion characteristics of his transmitter so that the, what is it called now? 8-level, 8VSB is the digital mode of transmission of modern-day digital television. He wants all of that to come out with high linearity. He would like all undesired products to be 40 decibels down. And by the way, your digital demodulator and your digital over-the-air television reception receiving system, sorry, drop. It must see a positive 27 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio. The desired signal must be 27 dB stronger than everything else that's in that 6 megacycles of bandwidth. In order for your digital converter to say, aha, I recognize that. Raise that, you lower that 27 dB of positive carrier-to-noise ratio, you lower it to 26, and most likely your digital converter will say, weak signal, or it's telling you high bit error rate, and it says, tilt, I'm not going to give you anything. Okay. You get a beautiful snow-free picture at 27.5. At 26, you get nothing. The audio disappears, the video disappears, you got nothing. It's got an extremely hard threshold. So you'd like the transmitter itself to start us with 40 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio of the basic transmission. That's the quality of the transmission. In order to do that, you're going to have real good standing wave ratio of the antenna. You don't want any signal reflecting back from the antenna, hitting the transmitter and being re-reflected forward as a delayed signal that's going to give you inter-symbol distortion. So therefore, the S22 is the main thing you care about, the transmitter. Will the transmitter take the signal reflected from the antenna, as small as it is, will it be able to absorb it, or will it re-reflect it forward? That is called S22. Output connector reflection coefficient. You're feeding a signal back into the output connector of this device of the test, and how much of it re-reflects forward. That's called S22 on a vector network analyzer. So, if you're real smart with directional couplers, I mean, yeah. I think that was Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. That sounds like a conversation we had last night. You got it right on the head.
Eric and I, at the wee hours of the morning, were talking about high-power transmitter linearity testing for digital service, digital television service. And we were talking pretty deep usage of directional couplers just right in order to be able to make the measurement. You're going to be doing it with directional couplers. There's no other way you can climb into that output 6-inch diameter coaxial cable running 5 kilowatts and not get yourself in a lot of trouble. By way of directional couplers, if you've got real good instrumentation, you can inject an extremely narrow pilot signal backwards into that transmitter and find out how much of it will the transmitter absorb. That is an S22 rating. If this was the best of all possible worlds, the transmitter would have an output of impedance, S22, of 50.0 ohms resistive, and all signals that come back into it in the wrong direction get absorbed like a perfect dummy load. Well, you can dream about that, and if you're real smart, by way of circulators and isolators, you may be able to create a transmitter like that if money is no object. But do real transmitters do that is a damn interesting question. As you can see, directional couplers allow you to make these crazy measurements if you're smart enough. KC2 WGB, K2RIW, the tech man.
KC2 WGB, very good thing. I think that just about covers it for the directional coupler. And we'll go over to Paul, and that's it for the mailbag. Back to you, Dick. KC2 WGB.
Okay. And guarantee we're going to get some more questions from Roy because, as you can tell, there's more to the story. But at least we're starting to clear away some of the cloudiness. The way dipoles are taught in our schools, from my point of view, it's a crime. We're led to believe that if you have enough understanding of Maxwell's equations, and boundary layer conditions, boundary value conditions, and you manipulate those three-dimensional matrix equations, that all of a sudden you're going to get an aha and say, hey, I see an antenna on that printed circuit, on that blackboard, by way of those equations, you're going to go out and build it. You're led to believe in the school that that's what's done as an antenna engineer. Absolutely not. It's not the way it's done at all. And so it is my belief that the current techniques for teaching RF engineering, particularly antenna engineering, in our good electrical engineering schools, for the most part, I think it does not give useful engineering information by which you could go out and design antennas. And here we are talking about wireless equipment. Let me drop it. You may have designed the world's best transmitter. You may have designed the world's best receiver. You may have real good quality of the transmission line going to the antenna. You may have real good sighting of the transmitter and real good sighting of the receiver. They're both on top of mountains. Until you connect an antenna to that transmitter, until you connect a receiving antenna to that receiver, you've got nothing. The most important, from one point of view, the most important component is the antenna. And that's the part that we almost don't teach anybody how to design it, how to improve it, how to test it, what does it do, how does it do it, how do you make it do it better? We don't teach our students how to do that. The ham radio operators, the way of the tinkering they do in their backyard, on the tops of their towers, on the tops of the roofs of their houses, on their chimney mountain, whatever, by the hard knock school, they find out what techniques antennas work. It's almost to the point where if you want an antenna engineer, you've got to hire a ham radio operator because the school do not teach that art and science. And the feedback mechanism to the school to recognize that failure of the instructional process, the feedback mechanism does not exist from all that I can tell. I can name on one hand a couple of electrical engineering instructors at some of our really good schools that do a pretty good job of teaching that, but they are rare animals. And in many cases, they got the knowledge to do that, not by way of the educational process. They did it by a mentorship of some kind. There was a mentor somewhere that helped them. They worked for a while in industry, in the real world, in the trenches where antennas are really being designed. They watched, they learned, they were curious, they asked questions, they found out how it's done. And then they went back to the school and teach it. That's a rare individual. Okay, Paul, WS2N, NASA needs some damn good antennas. And the best antenna in the world is that 8.5 gigahertz dish, roughly 12 foot in diameter, that's on Voyager. It only transmits a signal of 8 billion miles back to Earth every time we say, how's it doing out there? And we get a beautiful answer. That's an antenna. WS2N, K2RAW, the airport.
WS2N, yeah, in a 35-hour round trip to wait for that answer. So, incredible. Wanted to bring up, actually, a lot of little topics. We don't have any people blasted into space, so we've got the International Space Station up there. Six people on board of that. That's doing fine. There's a lot of unmanned projects going on. NASA just launched from California, from the Vandenberg Air Force Base, the orbiting carbon observatory. It went up without a problem. Got into a polar orbit, and well, probably around 400 miles up. I was following this because of some of the details that come out. Talked about how much carbon dioxide is being released that we as humans are releasing every time you turn around. They talk about 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide being released by humans. That's a big number. And that's annually, by the way. So, this is going to measure the amount of carbon dioxide being absorbed by the Earth, how much is being released. And to do it, the equipment on board takes a very narrow field of view, only like a couple of square kilometers as it's looking down. So do that, they compare it to the size of Central Park, you know, and it makes the swath as it goes around the Earth. It takes constant measurements. It'll collect 24 measurements every second, and it totals around a million different measurements every single day. Out of these millions, 100,000 are probably going to be good, 900,000 aren't. And they give a good reason on how can they have such a small field of view, this footprint that it's looking at, and it's because of the clouds. If a little bit of a cloud is in the way, measurement is no good. So, it cuts back the chances of every time it takes a sounding of seeing any kind of a cloud. So, that's why they have such a small field of view. But compared to the last one that they had up there, the last satellite that did the type of work, that thing took 4 seconds to make just one sounding. So maybe only 20,000 pieces of data per day, with about 500 being useful compared to the 100,000 on the new satellite that's going up there. So I guess global warming is a real thing. They say it's more CO2 up there than in the last, I think it's about 800,000 years or some bizarre number there. That's pretty much it on the new observatory. We're always trying to launch our rockets here. We've been having a lot of problems with SpaceX lately. It's been canceled. I don't know how many times. They should get it. They should get that thing off this month. Have a flight going up this week to the International Space Station, but not SpaceX. It's going to be Orbital Science. It's going to be launched from Wallops Island, Virginia, and it'll be taking the Cygnus spacecraft up there for the second mission for Orbital Science. They've actually done it two times already. The first mission counts as a test that they docked with the space station. So, but this will actually be the third time they docked with the space station, and that'll be going up hopefully Friday. Must have worked out the glitch that they had in their rocket. They tested a rocket last month and it didn't work out on the ground. they must have looked into it because last I heard they approved this launch, and that's the reason the other launch was delayed. WS-20. We're the only country with lots of problems now. Russia having a problem with their Angara rocket. That's a new rocket. The Angara rocket is designed to replace pretty much all their rockets, including there's different versions of it, including all the way up to their heavy lift rocket, the Proton rocket, eventually. But their first test, they detected something on launch pad, and they canceled that flight, so they're having their problems as well. That's a similar design to the Falcon 9, you know, they're going to have be able to put a bunch of boosters up to it, with fire there, liquid fuel there, boosters. They'll be able to have cross connections between all the rockets. They're taking that design from SpaceX, or the other way around. I don't know. That Angara rocket has been in development for a long period of time. Russia themselves is trying to get away from the monopoly that the Ukraine has had in building the rocket. As we all know in the news, they've had their problems with the Ukraine. But the idea of doing this, being built solely by Russia and eventually launched from a different launch facility that's being built in Russia, they're going to try to get away from the Cosmodrome and the Kazakhstan as well. So we'll see. They do have a planned version of this Angara rocket, which will eventually launch people, but they're a long way from that. They don't even have the funding. And unimportant issue. I don't know how far they're going to go with this. They're going to try operating these antennas, all kinds of equipment, detect steady signals, including time on the Arecibo Space Telescope and some of the other ones, some of the other big telescopes, you know, such as the low frequency array, the local one over in Europe, Green Bank, you know, telescope, I think we're over there, Dick. They want to use that one. And they want to search the nearest 30 planets that have been discovered by Kepler and really try to detect signals from those planets, maybe signals that they've been transmitting inadvertently. Say they have TV like us, they're transmitting signals. They want to be able to try to pick these things up. Funding is being put to this. I don't think it's any government funding. So I think probably some will be involved. Years ago, back in the early 90s, around 1991 or so, they had used the Arecibo telescope for its purpose. Some of the other money that was going in for SETI work. And you might remember Congress canceled that. They weren't about to spend 10 cents on this worthless project. So it looks like it's being dug back up out of mothballs and start doing this again. Hopefully with a little bit of luck this time. So now they feel they have better locations to point their antennas at. Well, we'll see what happens. One thing I wanted to mention about the International Space Station, the next, I think the two flights from now is that SpaceX is going to fly up there with their Falcon 9 Dragon. One of the things that will be on that Dragon is going to be a 3D machine, a 3D printer machine, and they're going to put that on the International Space Station. See what they could print out. The idea is eventually to build even tools or equipment, something that they might need out of these 3D printers. So they've come a long way. I think it's space ready, and it's going to be going to the International Space Station. So I think I covered enough. I think we'll leave it there. There's plenty more if there's dead air time. But there never is. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW. This is WS2N.
I have a question for Paul.
And Wes recognized, and I've got a question for you too, but I'll go to Wes first. Go ahead, Wes.
I would like to find out what is the update, if any, about the crash of $150 million investment of the flying saucer by NASA that it was a saucer space vehicle. It was at high Earth atmosphere that got tangled into the parachute and land splash into the ocean.
Is that the question, Eric? I mean, with reference to this balloon-shaped drag device that's going to be used, that NASA is doing a recent experiment, is that what you're asking?
That was June 28, 2014. It was failure of the test and 150 million experimental flight device slash the ocean that happened at Hawaiian Island, Hawaii, from Pacific Missile Range facility, and I would like to find out what is the update on it, if there's any.
You got a poll.
Yeah, well, as you know, it was just, it did take place from Kauai, Hawaii, and they considered that whole thing a success. Even so, the chute didn't completely fill with air. I mean, their goal is to see if the SIAD part would work. That would be the piece that actually inflates like a giant airbag, but you know, in the shape of a flying saucer. That worked 100%. So the other test equipment also worked 100%. They never tried anything like this. Don't forget, they used a balloon that by the time it got up to atmosphere, which was 23 miles high, 120,000 feet, the balloon was the size of, you know, a giant stadium. I'm not kidding. Millions and millions of cubic feet. Lift this 6,000 pound thing up to that height, but that part of the test went well because the balloon went up, the saucer dropped, the roughly 20,000 pound thrust rocket ignited. The cameras on board were taking pictures of all of this as it happened. I watched it live. It was right at the beginning of field day too, so I had the radio on and the computer on at the same time. But it took them almost 4 hours to get up to altitude. After igniting, it took off in height and went from 120,000 feet up to 180,000 feet. The idea of that is to get into that atmosphere, that altitude, that pressure at that altitude is very similar to what pressure would be coming into a Martian atmosphere would be. Martian atmosphere relative to Earth is a little less than 1% of what we have here on Earth. So they got up to that altitude, and this SIAD thing filled up with the air successfully, and the parachutes eventually deployed, but that part didn't work out. I listened to one of the guys, actually it was an interview before water flight, and one of the guys that's in charge of this whole operation, LDSSD project, the low density supersonic deaccelerating project. He said if it all goes as planned, I mean 100%, right down to the parachute, NASA, everybody would give him their group an A. If something goes wrong, they're going to get an A+. And that's because from one little mistake, they're going to learn so much. And that's what happened. So the reason the test equipment needed to be evaluated, make sure this all works by bringing it up with a balloon and all, and having a rocket fire and do this correctly, because next year at the same time, they plan on doing two of these flights. In fact, one of them might be with a larger diameter vehicle. This one was 21 feet, the other one won't be 26 feet. But they needed to know that this all would work. Delayed many times because the wind, instead of bringing it over land, they didn't want that. They wanted to go out over the water. They didn't want the balloon floating back, you know, and cut this thing loose and find out this thing lands in somebody's swimming pool. They don't need that. So it was delayed maybe about five or six times. Finally get off at the end of the month. That's pretty much it, Wesley. Back to you. This is WS1.
Yeah, it's interesting because this family does a victory. In 1976, NASA was so satisfied with the Viking in spacecraft that landed on the red planet. They were kind of using this technology. But talking about the failure as a success, I think, well, it's interesting because the first I find out about the total failure from Russian media, they were reporting Ukraine crisis. They used it as something immediate. We call it success, and we would say that the Buran, B-U-R-A-N, space shuttle of Russian, was the success as well. It actually was the... If you're familiar with Buran, B-U-R-A-N.
That was the space shuttle.
Yeah, it is. That was the correct orbiter vehicle. It was absolutely beautiful design. I've seen so much about it. And they also called it a total success, even though right now this thing is actually in the exposition in the Soviet Museum, and this thing never happened to fly to space. I would say this. Of course, we have to make an error to order to learn something.
But this fly, it flew one of, you know, in orbit and landed. It just didn't bring people up west.
Look, when you read something, you want to have a clear perspective of what it is and what you read it. For you, it's not important that there is a certain discomfort over certain information. You could say also that Los Angeles Times reported a great success of the NASA specialist, and they glorified Michael Gazarik, who is the head of the Space Technology NASA Headquarters program for this particular project. But it was a failure. It was an educational failure. That's what is the truth. And to engineer.
Well, maybe not everybody will agree on a failure. Because as Paul is saying, quite often failure gives you an awful lot of good information. The most interesting thing that I just heard you say, Paul, that the nearest exoplanets are going to be investigated by, I think you said, Jedrell Bank, going nearly down the 250-foot radio telescope, looking for a search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And I'm guessing that this is a privately funded thing. You know who Jill Totter is. She was or is the director of the Center for SETI Research at Berkeley. University of California at Berkeley is where she's also associated. And I think it's privately funded, that the SETI search that she's doing. So the SETI search that you're describing now at Jedrell Bank, if I understand it correctly, is that the only telescope that's going to be used? Is that privately funded? And although it's a long shot, I think it's a darn interesting research. you make the leap of faith to say that, hey, if the right conditions are there, life will be there, and you can make the guess that they're eventually going to be creating over-the-air broadcast radio and television. And if we've got a sensor there from receiver, we're going to hear those broadcasts. Those are some pretty good assumptions. Unfortunately, they're only based on a cross-section of one particular planet that we happen to know something about. So give me a few more words on this one, Paul. Who's funding it? How many radio telescopes? When does it start? How long is it going to last? How serious is this? I think it's at the nearest 35 extra solar planets. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, okay. And that astronomer, Jill, I think is her name was. She's the one that believed that they kind of like took a life and incorporated it into that movie Contact by Carl Sagan, actually a book by him, and it became a movie. And Ellie Hathaway, that's the name I'm looking for. That's the name that they used in the movie and the book. But it was like they met her and they kind of copied everything up after her, looking for little gray men. But this funding, I don't know where the money's coming from yet. I haven't figured that out. I know that Green Bank in West Virginia, Arecibo, one of the local ones, low frequency one, they want to cover different spectrums. And part of the idea is, let's say one planet in its star system is transmitting to another planet. For instance, we transmit regularly back and forth to Mars. And if they're doing that in another star system, and they kind of like line up with us, two of their planets in that same star system happens to be lined up with us, and we know where these planets are now. We know when they're going to be lined up. And they start taking measurements at that time. Signal appear. Modulated signal. That probably we wouldn't be able to figure out for some time, but they would be able to figure out if it was a modulated signal. Who knows? I had to bring that up. I wasn't happy that they canceled the canceled it back in 1982. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of Jill Carter, I think you're saying that the movie Contact was talking about her life, so to speak. So I guess you're saying Jodie Foster, the actress who played Hathaway, I think her name was really Jill Carter. Interesting. And so now found out from some source that you're going to tell me where it was, that's going to be using the Arecibo 1,000-foot diameter dish, that Green Bank 300-foot diameter fully steerable dish, is it 100 meters fully steerable dish, General Bank, it's a 250-foot dish. So I guess at various times, these dishes are going to be used for this extraterrestrial search, SETI search. And where did you read this up, Paul? And do you know who is funding it? And when does it start? So where can I read more about this? I'm hearing it now for the first time. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick. This was naturally on the internet. Most of the things I've been getting lately are from the internet. So, actually, they call it the Panchromatic Project. So if you put in the Panchromatic Project, PanchroMatic, you read all about it and read about the boring stuff. Who's funding this stuff? I really don't care. Yeah, you could take one, probably one Apache helicopter and probably fund this project, is my guess. I don't know that. But, you know, you've got 30 different stars which lie within 5 parsecs. That's roughly, what, I think 4.3 light years away. So it's probably 16 light years from the sun. So it includes, like, 13 single stars, a couple of binary ones, even a triple system. So who's funding it? I don't know. I didn't come across that. But, you know, the Berkeley Group, say they've got ex NASA people working for this group. Andrew Seaman is a chief scientist. Andrew Seaman, S-I-E-M-I-O-N. You'll be able to come up with it just by putting in the SETI Panchromatic Project. Thank you, Dick.
And I have one more question, football.
Yeah, what does panchromatic stand for? It sounds like chromatic means various portions of the spectrum. It sounds like they're bridging various portions of the spectrum. So I guess they're really going to be looking at multiple frequencies, maybe with a highly digitized, channelized receiver with a very narrow bandwidth that gives you great sensitivity. And it's got enough millions of channels that you cover a pretty wide spectrum and you don't miss anything in real time. So maybe it's the nature of the hardware being used to scan the frequencies where the dishes are aimed at these individual stars, and maybe that's where the name came from. And what were you searching when you first found this, and when did you first find this call? Is this something that occurred this week, or has it been around for 6 months? WS2N, K2LIW?
Somewhere between today and the last net, go through a lot of different websites, magazines, and stores. Years ago, I still loved the library, but internet is pretty good now. So don't remember what website it was on, Dick. I think I started with Aaron Sebo, because what's happened, I think what I was doing, I was looking up a story about using the Aaron Sebo telescope to examine the planets that are going around Jupiter. We would love to know, for instance, you take Europa. They believe that Europa has an ocean underneath it. Well, they don't know how thick that ice is. They don't know if it's a couple of miles thick or a couple of hundred miles thick. They just can't put their finger on it. So they would love to take a rocket, put up a transmitter, a receiver, in orbit around any one of these moons, especially Europa, and transmit a 10-meter signal down through it, through the ice, and that might be able to tell them how thick it is. Problem is, have a Jupiter up there with a tremendous, in the same frequency range, tremendous well, noise, transmitting constant noise, because of their magnetic sphere that surrounds Jupiter. But they say something like the equivalent of a megawatt of transmission that's coming out of Jupiter all the time. But we can't send a spacecraft, with a megawatt transmitter. Everything would be too big. The power supply would be too big. It's just not practical. But what they could do is use the planet Jupiter as a transmitter that's already transmitting. Let it bounce the signals, have the signals bounce off of the Europa. And we could detect it from a satellite. We could send a satellite up there and just with a receiver. And let's say you get behind, you create like a synergy. You have Jupiter behind you, and I'm the satellite, and now I'm looking at the planet. You detect the signal behind you coming from Jupiter, say 1 megawatt, and then it bounces off the planet and comes back, and what you receive in your receiver comes out, something different than what was transmitted. They'll be able to use that. Let me drop it. To detect it, to figure out how thick the ice is, and now they know how thick the ice is. They'll have a better idea of, what they're going to be up against in the future to try to, eventually get through that ice to figure out if there's microbes living underneath. I mean, that's the whole goal of everything. They want to find some kind of microbe or living something somewhere. So I started reading about the Arecibo Space Telescope. One thing leads to another, and they start saying that, on another article, related article, they start talking about this panchromatic project. Back to you, this is WS1.
Now, the Arecibo has got a very interesting, very recent history. And by the way, I also read on one of the websites that I've seen in the last few days that they've now discovered that that moon that you're discussing, I guess it's a moon around Saturn, I think it is, has a fairly thick ice covering, but also has fluid water underneath that has a very thick brine to it. And whether or not the living microbes can live there is another interesting question. And are we going to design a probe that bores a hole in that ice and samples some of that water and sees what's alive down there? But with reference to Arecibo, Kent, the D5BJB, brought to my attention in the phone conversation I had with him today that his close buddy, Joe Taylor, K1JT, he's the guy who invented the WSJT techniques, weak signal Joe Taylor techniques, by which by digital techniques we can listen to very weak echoes off the moon and through space and so on. Let me drop it. But he tells me that Joe Taylor did an experiment, I don't know how recently, but because Joe Taylor did get his Nobel Prize for the work he did at Arecibo, looking at some pulsars, measuring the Doppler shift of the pulsar, and recognizing the fact that the pulsar has a planet going around it, and it's tugging on the pulsar, making it go closer and further away, and therefore you see this cyclic change in the Doppler shift of the pulsar frequency. And that's essentially what Joe did to get his, that's part of what gave him the Nobel Prize. Okay, the story that Kent was telling me, that what Joe did some time ago, since he has this access to the Arecibo dish, he carefully chose a time where after they had replaced the feed horn to the new high-efficiency Gregorian feed horn, he timed a visit to Arecibo and went on the cable car to the focal point of the dish, apparently reached inside of that Gregorian feed horn at the focal point, which is at the focal point of the 1,000-foot diameter Arecibo dish, and with his hand, he keyed his handy-talkie and sent a signal of a couple of watts from his handy-talkie. I'm not sure if it was on 2 meters or 440, but he sent that signal to the moon. The echo he got from the moon gave him full quieting signal into his handy-talkie. That's an antenna. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Wow. Forget about the Nobel Peace Prize for that. Pulsar, they should give it to him for that. Just use my HT to talk to the moon. Wow. Very well done. So, yeah, that's pretty much all I got. I want to see this, I do want to see this thing take off on Friday. And, depending on the time, I didn't write the time down. It doesn't really matter, even if it's in the daytime. If you look to the west, correction. No, if you look to the southeast, the south, think about that. Southwest. You should be able to see this thing rise about 5, 10 degrees into the sky. So, keep a lookout for. But try to keep track of all this stuff, Dick. Wanted to talk about Mike. Mike had an interesting topic about the Bob's launch. So maybe we can get him on. I don't know if he's listening, but trouble are making the repeater. K1MJM. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Question for the call.
Let's go back to that for a second. I did hear Mike signing in earlier, making sure that his transmitter was working well. What did Mike send to you, K1MJM, with reference to a recent space experience that he had? Run that by again, Paul, and then we're going to turn it over and see if Mike is available. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, you could ask him about it, but I got the YouTube on it. It launched down in Wallops Island, so interesting. There's a lot of rockets that go off that never make the news, but they're pretty fantastic. A lot of things happening, but we'll see if he's out there. Mike, are you with us? K1MJM, this is WS2N.
Roger that, K1MJM listening.
You've got the floor, Mike. Give us some words on this particular subject that that the Paul just brought up, and you sound real good tonight. Get a good propagation, or you put up a bigger antenna. You've got it, Mike. And by the way, Mike is Mike number two of Mike and Mike, and he's the guy who runs the website that's entitled LimeOnTechNet.com. You go there and you'll see some darn interesting information, some mind-blowing pictures from Mike.